fields. We have somebody finally coming to talk to us about Pioneer Anomaly. We thought if we waited long enough, it would go away. Since it hasn't gone away, we need to find out about it. In addition to the colloquium series and to the talks which get announced in different areas, there are some discussion groups, group meetings going on, and two of them are here. On Thursdays, the time isn't fluctuating, but I think it's 1 o'clock. In the Alice room, we're going to be having quantum gravity seminars and discussions. And tomorrow, we have a visit here from Lewandowski talking about diffeomorphism and quantization of scalar fields. And on Fridays at 2, our extreme group meetings, and this is probably precise, but my understanding is that the discussion for this Friday is about issues having to do with effective field theory and the landscape, i.e., should we worry, or is there maybe an out? We don't have to take seriously all of the 10 to the 500 or whatever string theories. And these are both, they won't always be announced, but these will be ongoing activities, and everybody is welcome. And today, we're very pleased to have Sean McGee. Sean has been visiting and is continuing to visit from the University of London. Sean is one of the rare people who has contributed things which were important, really seminal in both mathematics and physics. He has been a very, very important intellectual person in the field of quantum groups, non-commutative geometry, and many, many other issues related. We're very pleased to have him, and he's going to tell us about the origin of quantum non-commutative geometry.
Thank you, Lee.
And that should work.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you for a fine introduction. And I must say, I'm very excited to be here. It's a wonderful mixture of different subjects and a great atmosphere here at the perimeter. Now, I probably have to give you the big picture. So, and make sure that I told you simple things like what a quantum group is. So I will spend 20 minutes on that, and some of you could walk out and come back in 20 minutes, if you like. Even if you've seen a quantum group definition before, I want to tell you what it really is philosophically. So even that might be interesting, at least, even if you know the definition. And all you need to know for this talk is what an algebra is. Okay, so does anybody here not know what an algebra is? Okay. Good. So a pop algebra or a quantum group is an algebra. So there's an algebra. So an algebra H with a product map, H tends to H to H, and a unit. Now normally you think of a unit as an element, but a linear map from C, the same thing as giving an element. It sends a lambda to lambda times that element. So think of a unit as a map. And it's based on axioms. And so the pop algebra is an attempt to make everything in algebra invariant under reversing arrows, which is some kind of time reversal or something, it's quite deep. And so, as well as, so H, instead of being just an algebra, it's also a co-algebra. Now, if you knew what an algebra was, which you said you did, then you also know what a co-algebra is. A co-algebra is just an algebra with all the arrows reversed and the axioms. So here's the axiom of a sensitivity of an algebra. If you were to multiply n tensor identity, you would be in H tensor H. If you were to multiply again, you would be in H. If you were to go the other way around, identity tensor M, you would be in H tensor H. If you were to multiply again, you would be in H. And so commutativity of that diagram, meaning that if you go around that way or go around that way, you get the same answer, that is the axiom of associativity. Similarly, you can write all the other axioms of an algebra as diagrams. Now, algebra is the same thing, but just with the arrows reversed. So it means that there is a map, H, into H tensor H, called the co-product, or if you like, unmultiplication. And then there is a map, so delta tensor identity, you can apply it again, or you can apply it again this way, identity tensor delta. Okay, so those are your two possibilities, and they should be the same. And so that eventually also commute. That's why I haven't written the axioms out, because you're supposed to be able to figure that out. Now, the they should be compatible. You don't want them to be just independent. So there should be something. So the co-product delta should be multiplicative. So if you multiply first and then apply delta, the same as applying to other first and then multiplying in the tensor product algebra. And similarly for this thing which is called the co-unit, this plane is the dual of a unit. And so those axioms, again, they're not the most diagrams, they are invariant under arrow reversal. So because this involves multiplication and co-products, and they just get reversed in their role, but the axiom remains unchanged. Now, then you should have something like an inverse. And so that's going to be a map from H to H, like a group inversion. And it should have this property that if you apply the co-product to phi s, and then phi multiplication, you get something trivial. And we'll see later on that that really encodes the group inverse. And again, this axiom is invariant under arrow reversal. So now, one consequence of being invariant under arrow reversal is that for every hot bounded rule, there is, at least in the five-dimensional case, and if you're with care in the n-dimensional case, there is a dual hot bounded rule. And that's just because if you have a map between two vector spaces, then the adjoint map, phi star, will go from W star into V star. So taking duals is a way of implementing arrow reversal. And so since the axioms are very under arrow reversal, the dual object defined with the adjoint maps, in other words, the product on H star is given by the coproduct on H, and vice versa. You will again get a hot algebra on H star. But more deep than that is this fact that since the axioms are invariant, you only have to prove half your theorems. Because if you prove a theorem like this one, that of course usual inverse should be anti-multiplicative. If you take AB inverse, it's the same thing as B inverse times A inverse, you flip the order. And that's indeed true. From the axioms up there, you can go home and prove that. Now, once you've proved that, you can take that proof, write it as diagrams, reverse all the arrows, and you will have a proof of this other theorem over here. So this is what I call prove one theorem, get one free property. Okay? But now, the philosophical part of this talk is, what is the physical meaning of that, interpretation of that? So what it says is that every phenomenon in physics, if you believe the Hofstadter rule has nothing to do with physics, there should be a dual phenomenon, or let me call it a co-phenomenon. And it will appear something different. It's a different theorem. That theorem is not proved from that theorem. It's just that there's a meta-theorem that says that if you prove one, you can prove the other. So these are different phenomena. And so we should try to... So let's hear some examples of action. So an algebra acts on a vector space. Similarly, a co-action, so that's a map from H tends to V into V. That's an action, right? A co-action is a map going the other way. V into H tends to V is a co-action. And you can write down axioms, which are just the dual. You don't use them so much in physics, but you could do. But what about in physics, an algebra might be an algebra of observables in quantum mechanics. So you've got some algebra, quantum mechanics, you've got the elements of the algebra of the observables. Well, the dual space, in the case of a hot algebra, the dual space is where the states live. The state in the mathematical sense, phi, an element of H star, phi of A is the expectation value of A in state phi. That's the physical picture. And but in fact, in case of a hot, if the algebra result was a hot algebra, then the states themselves form an algebra, which what's called the convolution product. So two states, phi product psi, this is the product in each star. If the value on A is going to be apply the co-product of A, and then apply phi tensor psi to it. So that would be the joint expectation value of a piece of A in state phi and a piece of A in state psi, where those pieces are the result of applying the unproduct or co-product. And that would be an algebra. So you have the symmetry there. But of course, that's interesting because then somebody else could say, well, these are actually the observables. And what we thought were the observables were the states. And they would write, instead of writing A of phi, a phi of A, they could write this as A of phi and have a completely different interpretation. So that different interpretation, from our point of view, will be some different physics. So for example, entropy is something that you do with states. But from this other point of view, entropy is something you do with states. But from our point of view, we also have something we do with observables, which would therefore be called co-entropy. And the co-entropy of an observable would be the entropy viewed when the element A is viewed as a state on the dual system. So when A is viewed as a state, then phi is viewed as an observable. For any observable phi. So you have these dual notions, and I want to explore that a little bit in these 20 minutes. Now, the first thing is to give you an example. Why do quantum groups contain ordinary groups? Which, of course, they should do if they're an appropriate generalization. Well, actually, although we only have one concept, it's a hot boundary, we have two ways of embedding ordinary groups. So groups can be over hot boundaries in two ways, depending on your point of view. So the first point of view is the point of view in geometry, where you, the algebra you're interested in geometry is the algebra of functions on a manifold. So if you have a group manifold, then you can take the functions on it, and the basis, for example, given by double functions, let's say this is a finite group or something, then you've got the double functions. You've got this coproduct. Now this coproduct, which is a new ingredient, is the coproduct of delta x is the product of double functions of things whose product would give x. So it's a kind of unproduct. That's the kind of interpretation of delta. It's okay. And inversion you see corresponds to group inversion. The antipode S corresponds to group inversion. We have notion of integration, where just delta function has measure one. Now another point of view of groups is not as coordinate rings, but as symmetries. And again, these also arise in physics. For example, if you have a non-Abelian symmetry in your physical system, then the non-Abelian symmetry generators, that is the group itself, not its coordinates, but the group itself should appear among your algebra observables. And so your algebra observables will have a non-Abelian component if the group is non-Abelian. And so this is the hot algebra H. It's generated by the group elements, or if you like, by the Lie algebra elements, in which case it's the enveloping algebra. The product is just the group product extended linearly. And the co-product is something that you don't even think about. It's just a diagonal map. So you don't, it's sort of invisible, you don't think of it, but it's there in the background of group theory. Again, S is given the inversion. Here there's a notion of integration, but now it's not what you would call integration. Integration is from this point of view, but that same concept applied to this other hot algebra gives you something different, which is evaluation of the identity. And now, for any hot algebras, the category of hot algebras is invariant under this arrow-reverse or dual objects, and that gives you a theorem, which is called Fourier transform. And that takes you from any hot algebra H to the dual hot algebra. So there is, in general, there will always be a Fourier transform, which is called the quantum group Fourier transform from H into H star. And in fact, these two hot algebras are dual to each other. So this is like H, this is like H star, although they're both viewed as hot algebras H here. So there will be a Fourier transform map from this hot algebra to this hot algebra. And that goes from this to this. Now, if the group is abelian, then the group algebra is actually commutative. And because it's commutative, it will be functions on some space, and that space is the space G hat of characters, or one-dimensional representations of my Abelian group. And so the usual Fourier transform goes from, let's say, position space over here, G, functions on G, will transform it to functions on G hat, in the case when G is Abelian, like let's say it's Rn. So functions on momentum space. So G hat is momentum space. However, when the group is non-Abelian, we still have this well-defined Fourier transform, but it doesn't have any interpretation in the usual way, because this side over here, CG, is non-Abelian, right? This algebra is non-commutative when the group is non-Abelian. So this algebra cannot be functional in any space. We want to think of it in quotation marks as like functions on G-hat, but G-hat doesn't exist, and this space doesn't exist. So this is an example of non-commutative geometry, which occurs in ordinary physics, just when you're thinking about non-Abelian symmetries. And so as soon as you have a curved manifold, a curved position space, for example, the non-Abelian group, then its symmetries naturally form have non-trivial commutators. That's called the curvature. And that means that the natural momenta are non-commuting. They will not be, the momentum space, therefore, is not an ordinary commutative space. It doesn't exist. The G-hat doesn't exist. But it exists as a hot boundary. So you have a well-defined quantum Fourier transform. And in general, for any hot algebra, you would just take the integral, f, and you would take this canonical element, which is a basis and a dual basis. And if the hot algebra was some weird hot algebra, this would be some weird element. In this particular case, it just reproduces the usual Fourier transform. Okay? So that's an example. Now, if you believe all that, which I hope you do, then we can also have some fun with this duality property. So let's suppose instead of that this was not, that this guy was position space, and this guy was momentum space. So that would correspond. So that would be the other way around from what we're used to. So that would be thinking of such non-Abelian symmetries, some enveloping algebra or group algebra, in my algebra observables, thinking of that as functions on some non-existing space, some non-commutative space. Is everybody happy with that? So the idea is we have an algebra which we think of as like coordinates, but these coordinates don't commute. An example, angular momentum in physics. Angular momentum is an observable in your system. They are there, they're operators, but these operators are not functions on classical phase space because they're not commuting. So you need the quantum thing. But we can still think of them as from that point of view. And so an example we can do a group theory on, and we can do Fourier transform. So Fourier transform will take you from non-commutative momentum space to curved position space. But we've also got this dual idea of taking my momentum space curved, so that would be like C of G, and I would map it over on the Fourier transform to non-commutative position space. So that is the meaning of non-commutative position space. Now, non-commutative position space, or space-time, has been proposed as a possible new effect in physics. Some of you are here are working on that. And I just want to give you the philosophical picture behind it. And this effect is something not gravity. Gravity is this first line. This purple line is something new. It's a new physics. I call it co-gravity. Okay. Now, probably going a little bit too slowly. So here is the general picture. Where do compound numbers fit in, or quantum groups fit in? Well, actually, what I've explained to you is a tiny bit of this diagram. So here we have group duals, non-abelian groups, like mean groups, and they're group duals. And abelian groups fit into both the special cases, and they are self-dual. If you've got an abelian group G, you've got an abelian group G hat. If you've got a hot-bounded rate, you've got a hot-bounded rate star. So this axis here is self-dual. You can do Fourier transform from within that category to itself. But if you try to take a non-abelian group, its Fourier transform will be something weird, unless the non-abelian Fourier transform, or in that case, if you're a hot-bounded, it becomes a quantum group Fourier transform.
You have the irreducible representations. Yeah. Is there a sense in which the irreducible representations of the non-abelian group are dual to them?
Yes. The representations themselves, just for pure numerology, doesn't carry enough information. For example, S1 and SU2 have the same set of representations. They will be integers or half integers. But so if you want to have the full reconstruction, you have to reconstruct the group itself. You need more than just the label representation. You need more information, and that information is contained. You can either do it two ways. You can either do it with 3J symbols, etc., and all that, or you can view them, as I told you, as a hot boundary. So if you view non-abelian groups, the information contained in the group dual as a hot algebra, and view non-abelian groups as a hot algebra, then you have the two hot algebras which were on the previous slide. And then the Fourier transform becomes hot algebra Fourier transform. So hot algebras are a receptacle, are a more general concept, which are a receptacle for non-abelian groups and information contained in non-abelian group duals. Now, if you think of non-abelian group duals as abelian quantum theory, and think of non-abelian groups as the beginning of geometry, then we have quantum groups as a toy model or a microcosm of quantum gravity, by which I mean quantum effects unified with gravity. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the graviton is quantized. It means that the gravitational effects are consistent in some reasonable way and probably modified in the process. Of course, we'd like to know what the next most general category is. And that was actually I found that in 89, and that is a model function. I'll come to that in a moment. Now, right now we're just having fun in the category of quantum groups or hot algebras, viewed as a unification of groups or geometry and group duals or quantum. And so, for example, you could ask this following question: suppose that I've got some position space, function on position space, and I've got some momentum, non-abelian momentum, and I want the two to be embedded in some algebra results, and I want H. That algebra results to be a hot algebra. Just suppose that. Then there's a theorem that says that if your algebra results is a hot algebra, contains position this way, contains momentum that way, then it is actually of a certain form. And this certain form, which is called a bicross product hot algebra, consists of this guy acting on this guy and making a semi-direct product. And that actually has a standard interpretation. That is a standard mapping quantization of a particle moving on n under orbits of the group G. So if you were to quantize, if you had some space, M, and you had orbits under the action of group G, and you were to quantize that in a more or less standard way, this is due to Mackey, but can be understood also in terms of Poisson geometry, then you would write that down. That would be the semi-direct product, hot algebra. This has the algebra of position space, it has the angular momentum momentum generators, and it has the cross relations, which generalize Heisenberg's relations. That is a standard way of quantizing particles on homogeneous spaces, and that's what you're forced to by this theorem. Except that at the same time, the dual is also a hot algebra, and the dual consists of another system where now there's a particle moving in G under the group M. And the data needed in both cases are highly constrained. G has to act on M in order for this picture to hold, and the other picture also has to hold. We have to have G acted upon by M. And so for this dual system also to hold, there are some tightly constrained equations, and these equations are nonlinear and have singularities, somewhat like Einstein's equations. So, So I call them, so this is our toy paradigm for quantum gravity. It really emerges something like Einstein's equation. And the simplest example is the real number is R. So we have position space R, momentum space R, and we ask how many ways can we smash them together in such a way the end result is a hot particle. And the answer is there's a two-parameter family of solutions. That extension problem has a two-parameter family of solutions. I've given the parameters names, H bar and gamma. And this is the answer. So this is not, there's no input here. This is just philosophical input. I've got a real line of position, I've got a real line of momentum. How many ways can I bring them together to get a Hopf algebra if I were to suppose it was a Hopf algebra? That assumption alone forces me into this family with these two parameters. And this, you can see, is the deformation of the Heisenberg relations. And this is some non-abelian group structure. So there's non-abelian group structure unified with quantum theory, but both of them modified. And this behaves, I won't go through it now because I haven't got time, but this behaves, this is called the Planck scale Hopf algebra, and it unifies, it has properties, it has singularity at the origin. So it's a particle, with Hamiltonian p squared over 2m, if you were to compute the Planck evolution with that, with these commutation relations, you would, so a free falling particle with these modified relations, then the particle will go more and more slowly as it approaches the origin. And there's some kind of event horizon at the origin. Okay. Now, just to finish the generalities, this is my 20 minutes introduction. What comes next? So I mentioned about observer-observed duality, and I mentioned that. Okay, so the Hopf algebra paradigm is one. What's the next algebra category? Well, mathematically speaking, this is a purely mathematical question. The answer is monoidal functors. So a monoidal category is a category with a tensor product. So certain things which you can make a tensor product. A monoidal functor is a map between two such things. And for every triple like that, every monoidal functor, there's a theorem that there's a dual one. And so this generalizes Hopf algebra with duality. And quite interestingly, very recently, Fred Hagen and a guy who was here, in fact, I forgot his name, collaborators, have formulated covariant quantum field theory on a curved background exactly as a monoidal functor from a category of so they have all the manifolds into C-star algebras. So that would be an example in this category monstar. The category monstar is the category of all monoidal functors. That's an example, just in the same way as classical groups were an example of Hopf algebras. So the question, so then if you want to look for more interesting examples of quantum theory applied to gravity, you should look in this category, but for deformations of this particular example. Okay, so that's my proposal for next year. Anyway, I'll turn to non-commutative geometry. That was my introduction to quantum groups, and I'm very happy, provided you give me a bit more time afterwards, to be interrupted and ask questions now about Hopf algebra, if you want. Or I'll.
There was a scale you mentioned, Planck scale, right?
Yeah. Okay, so that's. It's quite interesting. It's just comes out of the analysis. This is an extension problem. I've got two algebras with a generator called X, a generator called P. For these two algebras, in the case of R. And of course, and then I consult the extension problem, and I find that there are two parameter family of extensions. And I've just given them names, H bar and gamma. And this is a parameter which we can obviously know this interpretation. This has the dimensions of curvature. And of course, and if you were to analyze that problem I mentioned to you, that if you look at a particle falling in from large X, at large X, this is small, and so that behaves like a flat space. But as you approach the origin, you will goes more and more slowly. And if you compare that motion with, let's say, a particle falling into a black hole in radio Schwarzschild coordinates, the philosophy here is that p is not the canonical momentum in the sense of physicists, conjugate momentum. What p is the canonical momentum in the sense of what's conserved. So by definition, p is going to have Hamiltonian p squared over 2m. Instead of modifying p by adding the potential to it, instead of modifying the Hamiltonian by modifying the potential, I modify the commutation relationship with p. So that's the setup. But you can fix one or the other as long as you don't vary both. So that's the framework that I'm thinking about.
And if I have a curved momentum space of X, curved X space of the
measure,
and I have interactions, how can I get from one to the other?
Basically what you're asking is in this picture, in these models here, the position space is classical but curved in terms of its coordinate ring. The momentum space is non-commutative, which means, But and the other, in this other model, well, you can interpret the other way around. But if you want to have both, you just have general boundaries here, that's all. See, so you keep the same philosophy. You think of everything which you're going to do with regard to classical geometry, you keep on doing it, even when the whole algebra is both non-commutative, so it's partly like that, but also non-commutative, so it's also curved. See, so when the curve is not symmetric, that corresponds to a non-linear group. So for a general quantum group, you could, so this construction also works, this theorem also holds for general Hopf algebras. You can put any Hopf algebra here, any Hopf algebra here, any Hopf algebra here. And what you want a Hopf algebra which is not simply commutative, but as well as having a non-trivial co-product so that it corresponds to a non-linear group, it's also non-commutative, it's also, also right. So that's how you do it.
One other question. This is a very simple way of question. If there's an alpha theorist, you go from x space to momentum.
Yeah.
If you like to find the diagrams.
Well, I mean, so
when you have curved space time, you lose the idea of Fourier, simple Fourier transform. So how do you do final diagrams?
Yeah, so it's a very good question. So the answer is you can do Fourier transform in sense of one particle, in sense of just geometry, right? One particle physics. If you want to talk about Hopf space scattering, etc., there are some. There's a really big conceptual issue which everybody skirts around, including me, which is that you can write down momentum. It's no problem because it's some non-abelian group. I'll show you an example later on where we have a non-abelian group for the momentum. Okay, and so your momentum for your particle, for your waves, are labeled by non-abelian group elements. The only problem is that I have no idea how to make sense of some scattering process. P1 going in, P2 going in, and I write P1 plus P2, right? For the total momentum. But do I write that, or do I write P2 plus P1? I don't know, they are different in non-linear groups.
So the delta function for conservation momentum is lost.
Yeah, it's worse than that. You know, if I have this process and the process with the two reversed, if I've chosen some definition description for how I interpret the plus sign, then I've got different answers. So there's some philosophical input from physics needed to understand quantum field theory on curved momentum space. It's not as simple as people make out. But from the mathematical point of view, there isn't really a problem. It's more of a physical interpretational problem. Okay, so. Okay.
Is there a physical interpretation of this co-product, for example, in that little example you
gave? Yeah, you see, the interpretation always goes back to one of these two points of view. So depending on your point of view, and what's really fun is to take both points of view simultaneously. But if you take this point of view, the interpretation of the co-product is it encodes the group structure, because I'm using the group structure here to determine what my x and y should be. Instead of all those things which was product in the group gives me x. So the group structure is being built into the co-product, and it's equivalent to the co-product. And if the group is non-abelian, then this guy is not symmetric. That's the analog of being non-commutative. From this point of view, it's the other way around. From this point of view, the algebraic non-commutative corresponds to non-abelian group. But here, the co-product is something which is symmetric. And so that's the classical group. But if that was not symmetric, then that would be a quantum group from this point of view. So you can take either point of view, and depending on how you're thinking of it, you can think of the co-product those ways. But for this talk,
that's the mathematical view. What's the physics?
Well, the point of view throughout this talk is really this one. I'm thinking of my algebra as coordinates on some space, which may be a classical space, or if the algebra is not commutative, then it's some non-existing space. Okay. So maybe that brings me conveniently to the next topic, which is how to do geometry on algebras with coordinates which are non-commuting, because that's what we've got for examples of. Okay? And so how do we do that? Well, that's an ongoing project, not even to do with quantum groups, but Alan Bond and people have been thinking about this for many years. But there's an approach coming out of quantum groups, which basically says that if you want to know what geometry is, you should first understand symmetric objects, then understand like groups, then understand homogeneous spaces, then understand more and more complicated manifolds. So rather than talking about abstract C-star algebras and axiomatics which don't really work, the quantum groups approach is very much based on examples and symmetry. So, but the main ingredient is common to all approaches to complicated geometry, and the main ingredient is differential structure. So what do you mean by differential forms on an algebra when the coordinates are non-commuting? And the answer is surprisingly simple. You just axiomatize the things you really, really want. So what you really want is to have some space that you call space of one form, a ring of one. You should be able to multiply one form from the left to the right. But the two should be associative. So if you multiply from the right and then from the left, you get the same answer the way around. So that's called the bimodule. Bimodule because you multiply from both sides. Okay, but the two are compatible. So that means multiplying a function. A, the algebra is like functions. Only the one is like one forms. So I can multiply functions, one forms by functions from the left or the right. Then you should obey the Leibniz rule. That's that one there. That uses the bimodule structure. then the space of the things of the form ADV should generate all the 1 points. That's kind of obvious. And then the kernel of D should be 1. The only thing that's killed by D should be the constant function. That corresponds to a connected manifold. So these are the 3 axioms. And when the algebra is a group, that is like a quantum group, so it has a co-product which encodes a group structure, it's natural to ask for the thing to be translation invariant. Now if you ask, because you see, for example, even in classical, in ordinary geometry,
it's a blackboard under that.
Oh, thank you. And in classical geometry, you've got things like fake R force. The calculus is not, on a topological space, there is not necessarily a unique differential structure, even in classical geometry. The same is true for any algebra. For any algebra, there's not a unique differential structure, unique specification of 1 forms. In other words, these axioms have many solutions. But if you ask for translation invariant under a group structure, in the classical case, that makes it unique. So topological set has a unique legal structure if it has one at all. And so we ask for that. We ask in the Hofmannsthal case for the translation of the invariant. And in that case, it's not essential, but in that case, a lot of things simplify. You get the higher forms automatically. You get, with V squared equals zero, you get metrics and bundles, etc. You can do a lot of geometry. But that is a theorem. This is the theorem I want to tell you about today. So a theorem is that for a non-commutative deformation, so suppose I've got some algebra A, which has a deformation, I'm not going to call it, so A lambda is a deformation of some functions on some manifold. By lambda. So that means to say AD minus BA is lambda some passing bracket AD plus higher order. I'm not calling this H bar. Why am I not calling it H bar? Because what the effect we're talking about is not necessarily the quantum mechanics, it could be cogravity. We shouldn't mix up quantum mechanics with deformations. Anyway, there's some parameter lambda. And now the theorem is that in generally, for a sufficiently non-commutative algebra, A, or A lambda, there will exist a one form which sort of implements D by commutator. So D of something will be commutator. Remember that one form don't can be the function. So A is a function, theta is a one form, which I'm claiming exists, and the commutator with theta is going to generate D, it's going to be some one form. And that is impossible classically. This equation has no meaning whatsoever. It's completely invisible in classical physics. Because in classical physics, this side is zero because lambda is zero. This side is zero because functions can be with one forms. So there's no commutator to talk about. But in non-commutative geometry, this is a possibility, and it's almost always true. So it's a general phenomenon. Now, let's hope that we've made some deformation. We've got some generators dxi for my one forms over here. I quantize them I've also called them dxi. Maybe I should have put the hat on. But I quantize them to dxi in a lambda. In omega of A lambda. But this guy, theta, has nothing to do with classical physics. It's there in the quantum theory, but it's not nothing to do with classical physics, so it doesn't necessarily come from anything. Okay? So we have a possibility of something new, which is not visible classically. And now let's define partial derivatives in the standard way in geometry. Partial dA, A is some element of my algebra, dA is going to be some one form. I've got a basis here, dxi, I've got another element of theta, they're forming a basis. Let's suppose they're forming a basis. Let's suppose that's the only thing I have to add, maybe I have to add more. Then they form a basis. So I define the partial derivatives as operators from A lambda to A lambda by this formula. Right? That, if you think about geometry, that is how you define partial differentiation. It's defined as the coefficient of the exterior derivative in that basis. And this is what physicists call the conjugate momentum. So di are the conjugate variables to the dxi's, conjugate operators. But this d will have some operator associated to it, which we don't see classically. It may have a classical limit, though. So it may be that dividing by lambda, it has a limit. And that limit will be the induced classical Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is my summary. Axioms of translation invariant differential calculus on most known quantum groups, and this is now a theory, you have to analyze all quantum groups that are known, and you discover this remarkable thing, that in most cases, you can't do it. This theta doesn't come from anything at all. It actually has to be added. So the dimension of differential calculus, for most quantum groups, the smallest dimension is larger than it would be classically. It has this extra degree of freedom, theta, which is not visible classically. And so there will be this extra cotangent time direction. And what that's saying in physical terms is that the translation invariance of differentiation, of the differential calculus, which is there in the classical picture, is broken, is anomalous when we quantize. In symmetry, in physics, an anomaly is when you have a symmetry in the classical theory which is not preserved for some various reasons in the quantum theory. An that's exactly what's happening here. Translation variance of differentiation is not being preserved. And so that, and that's going to be the origin of time. Okay. And just in case you find that unconvincing, you can do the semi-classical analysis. After all, lambda is a parameter. You can do analysis in orders of orders of lambda. So let's look at that commutator of a function and a one form. And let's give it a name. So just as the Poisson bracket was the leading order part of the commutator of functions in A lambda, the leading order part of the commutator of a function with a one form, I'll give that a name. I'm going to call it nabla A, acting on DB. And I call it nabla because it's some kind of connection. It's technically a free connection. But it has a curvature. And if you look at this, you discover that the triple identity holds here precisely that order at the lowest order, precisely when the curvature of this connection is zero. So if you have, if your symplectic connection, your Poisson pre-connection, has curvature, then it will not be possible. If you cannot find a flat connection, a connection with zero curvature, then it means that you cannot have an associative differential calculus preserving all the classical dimensions. And that's why you have to have a special dimension. So you have two options to do. You need to have non-associativity of the calculus, which you don't want to do, that's the anomaly, or you can resolve that anomaly by adding an extra dimension, and that's the element theta. So you can make things associative again and fulfill the axioms that I talked about. So these axioms here are the two-level limit associative. So these axioms can be fulfilled. This is the associativity here. These axioms can be fulfilled with only an extra dimension. If you try to avoid extra dimension, you will be forced to have a non-associative calculus with curvature given by with anomaly measured by the curvature of something, which is the classic situation for anomalies. Anomalies are usually measured by curvature. Okay. So it's not usually when you think about physics usually, but there is a more or less conventional physical point of view going on there.
Yeah. Let me make sure I understand. So when you talk about translation invariance, you're talking about spatial translation.
Yeah, I'm supposing that I'm just quantizing space, thank you. I'm just quantizing space. I mean, it could be any algebra, this could be space time with some extra time, additional proper time or something. But let's suppose that A is space. So when space is made non-commutative, it forces time. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that translation, if space is a group like R3, then translation invariance under the translation of R3, under most quantizations, I'm claiming, is broken. And to restore it, you have to have an extra direction, extra time direction.
So this applies when the space is a fairly highly symmetrical space.
Highly non-commutative. The general theorem about distance of theta is fairly general. Most non-commutative algebras have them. The theorem that you are forced to adjoin this theta, and it doesn't exist in the classical picture, that's really let's just say you can analyze everything in great detail in the translation invariant case. But the phenomenon is probably more general. Okay. So now I'm just going to spend the rest of the time, 20 minutes, doing an example. Because really, you know, philosophy is one thing, but if you see it all how it works in practice, you might be more convinced. So this model here. This algebra is the algebra of SU2, it's angular momentum. But I'm viewing it as coordinates. So my XI are not angular momentum generators, they are V' position generators. So as I explained to you, that corresponds to momentum becoming the non-obedient but classical group SU2. We'll come to that in a moment. Let me just say some reasons why I'm studying particular algebra. Well, obviously, physics doesn't have any excuse for studying this algebra. But if you want an excuse, then there are reasons to think of from 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. Firstly, in papers of Schroeder, we talked about the quantum double symmetry. Papers by myself at the Feast of where we looked at this algebra and its geometry. And then more recently, Laurent showed how this algebra arises from the Fontana-Redi model as a next to classical approximation of quantum gravity. What that has to do with what I'm talking about now is completely clear, because that's 2 plus 1 quantum gravity. I'm talking about this as really as R3. So the picture is a bit different. But anyway, that's a good reason to study this algebra as a non-commutative space. Now, if this algebra as an algebra is a direct sum of matrix algebras, and each matrix algebra is given by setting the Casimir equal to a constant. And these are just the matrix blocks for the Hilbert representations. And so these matrix algebras, n by n matrices, regarded in this obscure way as this algebra modulo that relation. That's what's called the fuzzy spheres. That's just a strange way of thinking about n by n matrices. But we're not doing fuzzy state geometry, because what people who do fuzzy state do is they just work with this algebra. And that completely ignores the most important thing, which is the coproduct. So the coproduct doesn't exist on the matrix algebra. It exists only on the direct sum, this whole algebra here. So we are not doing fuzzy geometry, but we are doing something, we are doing non-primitive geometry. So we have this algebra, which is R3 lambda, and R3 lambda is like, think of it as like functions on R3. Quotation marks, and it has degenerated x up. That's the now, and it has a coproduct. The coproduct here, delta, corresponds to the addition law of R3. So when I talk about translation invariants, I meant in regard to this addition law. Okay? And that works even though the algebra is not commutative. Now if we go to some theorems, and there are classification theorems. For all main classes of quantum groups, including this one. So here there are theorems which I won't tell you, but mathematical theorems that say to classify the things obeying those axioms. So we're just going to solve these axioms. It's simply a very simple question. These very simple axioms, the minimal assumptions that everybody who works in the field agrees with are the basic assumptions. And I'm saying that those assumptions are, and translation invariants are forcing the following. Okay, so this is analysis. You try and analyze it, you try to solve those things, you work out that they correspond to ideals, classify the ideals, you do it all analysis, you discover that there's a unique answer. That they correspond to the representations of SC2, the smallest dimensional one is the Pauli matrix representation. And that means that the space of one forms is generated by functions and invariant one forms. And the invariant one forms are four dimensional space. And they are spanned by the Pauli matrices and the identity matrix. So I want to stress that this is not pulled out of a hat. The only ingredient in this entire talk, the entire rest of this talk, is this algebra. From this algebra alone, I'm analyzing, and even the coordinates of the algebra are irrelevant. Coordinates are, you could change the coordinates to some other coordinates. It simply has an abstract algebra. This algebra you can analyze its possible differential calculi, and this is the unique answer in these coordinates. And these are the commutation relations. You see that functions don't commute wrong in one form, so there's a lambda here. But there's an additional generator theta, and there's a parameter associated to it, a new parameter induced by theory. So there's one parameter family of calculi with this new parameter lambda mu. But mu cannot be zero. Now if you just say, I don't like this, I'm just gonna drop this term, right? That's the thing you would have. If you take that relation and apply a d to it, you might be led to something like this. You might, without this term, right? If you do that, you'll find it doesn't obey Jacobian identity. So Jacobian identity would be non-associative. And so this theta is exactly false. It's the only way to fix that breakdown of Jacobian identity is to have this extra variable theta. And notice you can't get rid of it because it ends with one of them in here. Now, let's continue. We define the operators di and p0 by quantum, and let's compute them using quantum group Fourier transform. So what does Fourier transform do? It turns differential operators, that's what these are, into multiplication in Lentil space. So here's the Fourier transform. We've got the dual Hopf algebra. This is the Hopf algebra which we're interested in, A. And this is its dual. This is the coordinate ring of SU2, because that's the end of the ring algebra, that's the coordinate ring. So that was the first point of view in the second transparency. And this is the second point of view on the right-hand side of the view. And Fourier transform takes from one to the other. So Fourier transform will function on SU2, it's just given by that, which in local coordinates looks like that. And notice here the plane waves. So P is simply a parameter for the plane waves. These are real numbers, P1, P2, P3 are real numbers, parameterizing the plane waves. Plane waves are simply elements of SU2. And differential operators become multiplication by EI in this algebra functions on SU2. So this is exactly how you use ordinary Fourier transform. And the theorem is that you compute it, you work them out that they are given by these functions here. And just to give you a quick idea of how you prove that, you look at this quantity x, which is just p dot x, and you discover that the commutation relations I showed you in the previous transparency are just imply these commutation relations among the x's and the thetas. And that's now a closed system, you can solve it recursively and find d of x to the n. Well, then you can find d of e to the ix, e to the x, which is what you need here. So you can compute the value of d on plane waves and find these guys. Now, look at that. That is a sine, and that is cosine. So cosine is square root of 1 minus sine squared, there's an I here, so that means that d0 can be written like that, where nabla is di squared, sum over I. So now, if you were to expand that in terms of lambda, you would have that. So d0, which is this extra direction, extra differential operator associated to this extra direction time, is actually Laplacian for lowest order. And so you just derive Schrodinger's equation. So you have to add all this time, and it's time of a Schrodinger's equation. And one of the stresses is that the coordinate system is arbitrary. I didn't have any input whatsoever. I just said, here's my algebra, here's the only possible calculus on it, this will automatically be induced, this operator. Okay? Now, of course, that's not this. We somehow haven't actually got time, we've just got this operator d0. Let's actually put time in by adding this variable t. So let's put t, let it commute with the xi's, and let's have dt is 0. And that way, d0 really becomes d by dt. Okay, so I'm adjoining time in such a way that theta, which is the conjugate of this d0, is really going to be it's really going to be dt. And now when you do that, apply d to that. If you apply d to that, you've got dt, xi, plus t, dxi. But dt, xi is theta. So what you've got here is d of t, xi. Well, the first term gives you dt, xi, but that's theta, and so that gives you dxi. So, and then the other term is this guy here, and the result is 0. So that means that dt with dxi has to be that. So t doesn't, although t commutes with functions, t doesn't commute with one forms, which is interesting. And then t again, you come with t again, forces this relation. So you're forced into these relations, and that means that if you take any function f of t and move it past, where mu now runs from 0 up to, is t or xi, f of t going past gets shifted by lambda squared over mu. And now from that you can compute that d of f of t is some operator, dt f of t dt, and that operator is this finite difference. Again, I'm not putting this in. This is just being forced to you from the algebra. So this t, although you thought it very innocent to add t, this t doesn't commute with functions, and d by dt is actually a finite difference. Of course, lambda could be very small, and lambda squared even smaller, so this could be a very small finite difference. So in some sense, space-time is being forced to be discrete, at least time is being forced to be discrete, although you didn't put that in. And now, if you want to compute what d looks like on an arbitrary wave function of x and t, you should look at products. So you do that, you apply the Leibniz rule, the rule axiom of the hot balance of the differential calculus, apply the Leibniz rule, do some calculations, and then whatever those coefficients are, that is what di is on a product, and that's what d0 is on a product by definition. So that is equal to that. So d0, I put a tilde to distinguish it from my previous d0. D0, d0 job is just d0 acting on a product of functions of x and t. And so that equation here, so the Schrodinger equation that we want, just has this very simple form, that d by dt of psi is 0. In other words, d psi is spatial. Has no dt component. Right? The coefficient of dt is by definition d0. The coefficient of dt is by definition d0. So I want d0 psi to be 0. And that will be the equivalent to saying that d by dt was the thing I had, was minus d0 I had before. So that equation, that there is that. So that translates to that equation here. This is d by dt. That's the finite difference, and this over here is my operator d0. Putting in what we had for d0, that was this given by this thing minus 1, cancelling the 1's, we get this equation. So the Schrodinger equation looks like that. That is the equation, that equation written out explicitly. And now that's the solution. And that's solved by plane waves of this type, provided you have this dispersion relation. So p0 has to look like, has to be like that. And the solution only exists if mod p is less than pi over 2 lambda. So there's some kind of Planckian cutoff. If lambda was the Planck scale in length, this is the Planck momentum scale, and the spatial momentum is being bounded by that. Now, that's of course a fancy term. What's really happening here is that the pi, the spatial momentum is just curved, and your coordinate system only goes so far, and eventually you're trying to go around the circle. So you, when the system breaks down, I'll put it another way, your mental space has been curved, so it's compact space. So obviously momentum is bounded. And so we see that here. There's not a this has the fancy interpretation of a Planckian cutoff. If lambda was a Planck scale, mathematically it's just saying that momentum space is being compacted by it into a sphere. So it's that standard. Okay. Now let's look at the dispersion relation a little bit more. Of course, the lowest order, this looks like p0 is a half p squared over mu. One over mu is the mass. So this equation here, Schrodinger's equation, up here, over here, that mu is one over the mass. So mu is a particle of mass m, which is one over mu. And this is the lower order. This is what you would have for a non-relativistic particle. P zero, the energy would be a half, would be p squared over 2m, and that's what you get. Okay. And similarly, the wave speed. Now, I'm not sure how to compute the wave speed. Assuming that the wave speed was given just by naive differentiation of the group velocity of the energy with respect to the p, then you would get that. And so you see the velocity blows up as p approaches the band, pi over lambda. But for small lambda, the group velocity v is approximately p over m, as it should be. So this is the correct thing for a non-relativistic particle mass m. Now, I want to say one thing here, that a lot of people write down dispersion relations like this, and they write down equations, not so much this one, but they write down other ones with a cosine.
Dispersion relation, how does it work for car?
For what?
For macroscopic objects.
Well, it depends on. For me, lambda is just a parameter. I perform my
scale. E, momentum, is just negative number. Then this dispersion relation should be a valid also for macroscopic objects.
Okay.
And we know for sure that there is.
I'm not making any claims about that. I'm simply because, firstly, the question of whether P is additive. It's not additive because these are local coordinates on a non-linear group SV2, and so they will be added using the Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff identity. But secondly, this theory is simply describing the coordinate ring of position space, which is one particle. It's not describing that car. It could be. You know, I'm supposing that the reason for the space being non-metric in the first place, the reason for lambda being non-zero, is because this is a semi-classical effect coming out of quantum gravity, or some deeper theory of quantum gravity. Nothing geometry doesn't have to be with everything. It's just a more general framework of geometry with which you can model effect, intermediate effects. So quantum gravity should probably go through non-metric geometry in its way to classical physics. And then if that was the case, then lambda would be a one of Planck scale. And then you wouldn't see this effect until the car was very, very massive.
But in any case, this is the one particle non-relativistic.
Exactly. Effect. Yeah.
So a car is a huge system.
It's not a trivial question. I mean, one could look at physical mechanics and see how it's affected by.
This is a very old story, just introductions of fundamental lengths into physics.
And yes.
Kadyshevsky, for example, he. Has spent all his life yes. trying to do
it. No, I should have said that, but the thing is that quantum groups allow you to do everything now very precisely mm-hmm. in a completely controlled manner. So the ideology, is not new, ideology is not new, but what is new is that we now have the technology to do it precisely as an actual theorem. Here I assume only the algebra, I proved this thing without any ad hoc input. This is what's more important.
So there's a question.
Yeah.
So, but you agree that we have to find elementary particle here. But this thing is an elementary particle. You have the idea of composite already built into this.
Yeah. I suppose that what I'm describing here is a deformation of the classical algebra observables, which is just functions on R3. So it's classical mechanics. Particle f of x is an element of R3. Classical mechanics had some evolution, etc., and I've just deformed this with a parameter lambda. Because if I'm ordinary geometry in R3, I've allowed that to be non-commutative, which you can interpret how you want. Just think of it as a deformation. And that is still only applies to only one particle.
Okay, so it's an elementary particle.
Yeah.
Well, it's something which was not in the original concept. So the original
see, I'm just doing geometry. You can interpret it how you want. But the most sort of naive interpretation of classical, the most obvious application is to say I've got my coordinate ring, which is algebra functions. A classical, a field in classical mechanics, at least in position space, function is a functional position space, and I've just let that position space be non-commutative.
Okay, so the that being the case, it's not so much of momentum cannot be additive, it's worse than that, it cannot be associative.
No, I don't know if somebody was saying it is associative. It's forming a Hopf algebra, etc.
Because if it is associative, you can put things together, and the concept of elementary particle disappears.
And what is elementary particle?
Yeah, you were asking questions which I think to answer them properly would expose serious philosophical issues on the application of this machinery. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Let me make a suggestion, because for people who are not experts, what's being raised is some debates among experts about the extension of this to five-space multi-particles.
Let me just say that these questions are very good ones, and they apply to all models of this nature. And I'm not answering them today.
Max Boller published a paper in the 30s in which he showed that you have a four-dimensional homogeneous space as well. Then you regularize all quantum field theory calculations in the X space. However, the problem is that the Boller reciprocity between P and X only works for the free particles. When you put any interactions, you lose the whole momentum space structure. This is what I was saying earlier.
Right.
And that's when you get into some serious trouble. This is an old story, but a homogeneous curve momentum space regularizes two things.
Indeed. This is an old story, and it's nice to be able to see it. The only thing I can say to it is that we are bringing forward new techniques for this old point of view. I mean, Schneider was also doing this in 1947. But we can now do that. At least we can analyze these questions that you're raising a bit more precisely, because we've now got the method of non-commutative geometry to address how that Fourier transform in a rigorous way. So
is there an answer?
No.
Let Sean finish, and then we can talk about the applications from one part of quantum mechanics to quantum field theory. And experts can argue about whether that's been done correctly yet.
It hasn't been done. So the answer is it hasn't been done. I think there's some good problems there. And I have some ideas how to address it. Okay. But let's ask for a minute. Okay, let's have a dispersion relation. But how the hell do we know? Because one of the things that physicists do is they write down this dispersion relation and they say, oh, well, you know, I call this P. And I call that X, I call this P0, I call that PI, therefore P0 must be the energy and PI must be the momentum, and therefore this is a physical prediction. But that's complete nonsense. These are just arbitrary coordinates. I've just chosen coordinates on my group ST2, I've chosen some completely different coordinates. The physics is not in the relation itself, the physics is in the relation in conjunction with how those P0 PIs are being used, namely they are being used to label the plane waves. So it's the equations in conjunction with the plane waves, and the physics is actually in the plane waves. So to really understand what the group velocity should be, you actually need to look at the plane waves and ask yourself, how will we detect it? So those P0 and PI coordinates are justified because they are appearing in this plane wave here, which were things we use in our Fourier transforms. And so we need to look at those plane waves and see what we'd observe if we had a coherent state detector of some kind. So, and this is again something missing in the literature for other models, but in this model, we can at least have a standard doing it. So the standard doing it is to construct minimal uncertainty states. So what you do is you look at, of course, SU2 has a standard Minor-Lorentz representation. So in this, for fixed spin, you've got a variable n. You've got these states here, j, n. And in that Hilbert space of states, you can look for coherent states with the property, which I call j phi psi, with the property that the definition value of x looks like a polar coordinate form for some arbitrary r. When you do that, you find a unique answer for minimal uncertainty, and you find also that r is quantized. You discover that the radius is actually 2j times lambda, and you discover that the angle between two of these coherent states is being detected in the quantum theory by the Braket inner product. So this is very similar to what happens with the minimal uncertainty states on phase space in the old works of Pauli, but now it's being used in this point of view. And it's also very similar to Penrose's spin network point of view, where he wanted to construct from the representation theory of SU2, he wanted to reconstruct the geometry. And instead of representation of SU2, we've gone directly to non-commutative geometry, but other than that, it's the same idea. Now, in those coherent states, our plane waves will appear like some fuzzy objects. We won't see waves. For example, for spin a half, what we'll see is that function here. And so But we do see something with periodicity. So we can at least argue that the periodicity of what, so the detector, if you can build a coherent state detector which has these things and takes these kind of different values, that detector will not see a plane wave like that, but it will see these efficient values. But you'll see some kind of fuzzy wave. But this fuzzy wave wouldn't have periodicity, and so this group velocity is perhaps a measure of what, to the extent that things can behave like a wave, that's how fast it would go. Okay, I have to finish up here. So I just want to mention some other aspects. Not in geometry, firstly, within the model that I talked about, which was something in space-time models, you can see I put here field theory as one of the open problems. And even for the bi-cross product model, the Kappa model, which is most well studied by physicists, even there, field theory is not understood, and fermions are not understood properly. So there is work to be done even there, and also for this model. But in this model, I didn't mention it, but the coordinate system is arbitrary. You can choose polar coordinates. And you discover a very nice algebra for if you assume spherical symmetry, then you just have you have one parameter c, which is x squared, which is the radius squared, and t. They form a closed algebra, primitive algebra, with a nice differential calculus. So you can do rotationally invariant physics, and particularly you can try to solve Schrodinger's equation for the hydrogen atom. I haven't done it, so I'm not sure what the potential should be. But you can also look at electromagnetism, because you've got the potential form, so you can write down curvature, electric magnetic field, etc. So you can do that kind of physics deformed by lambda. Then you can look at, this is something that Laurent has told me about, that if you look at the wave that arises from the quantum Regge model, and you were to look at the quantum constant, then you would get UQS. So now that's a quantum group, which is neither commutative nor co-commutative, but all of what I said before can be done. Because I just use the algebra. You can classify differential calculi, you get an answer quite similar to the one that we have. Also, the coordinate ring of SQ2, it's again a theorem, an older theorem, that the smallest differential calculus on it is again four-dimensional. But this phenomenon I told you is quite general. Again, you would think that SQ2, this is the coordinate ring of SQ2 that deforms the quantum group. You would think it should have a three-dimensional calculus, but it doesn't. The smallest calculus is four-dimensional. And again, it's an extra variable theta, and again, you get the Laplacian. So the d0 is now the curve of Laplacian. Now it's the Laplacian, it becomes the Laplacian on the sphere. So that had a natural time direction, and you've got the Q-Friedman model. Okay, and now Monte geometry in general, I don't want to give you the idea that Monte geometry is just about these kinds of things. Monte geometry applies everywhere where ordinary geometry applies. If you believe you have ordinary geometry in the picture, and you believe you have quantum effects in the picture, then Monte geometry should play a role, because it's simply a more general notion of geometry. And one example is functions on a finite set. Now, finite sets don't have any non-trivial differentiable structure. The only differential structure is zero. And that's because the axioms that Newton wrote down were too restrictive. But our axioms are a bit weaker. They're just the ones I showed you at the beginning. And those axioms mean that finite sets have a rich moduli of manifold structures on them. Even a set with three points has a rich moduli of manifolds on it that you can build differential structures. And differentials are about labeled by graphs. So if you're doing quantum gravity, I claim that you should sum over all sets of all sizes and all differential structures on them. And not just topology, which is what physicists think about, but differential structures should be summed over. And that means summing over graphs. And then for each graph, you will have put on your finite set differential structure. Then you will know what you mean by one-fourths. Therefore, you can know what you mean by Weierbrand's connections, and you can write down this action. You can then compute this action and extremize it. So that is my proposal for quantum gravity on finite sets, and I have assumed you worked it out for 4 points. Okay, 4 points is a bit too small, and we didn't get interesting answers, but you can do it. Okay. I mentioned about entropy and co-entropy, etc. And you can do all that. You can do random walks on quantum groups. You can explore relationships between information, at least between entropy and geometry. I'm not sure about information. This is a hot topic, so I put it in, but I don't know much about it. And you might try to look at the quantum measurement problem, because the quantum measurement problem, after all, is to do with, most of the paradoxes that are raised are to do with physical separation. So there's some geometry there interacting with quantum theory, so there should be a rather complicated geometry there. Then this observer-observed duality. This is a very weird thing that I mentioned. Why do you want a hot algebra to be a hot algebra? And I claimed that it meant you had a symmetry between observables and states. And if you believe in that self-duality principle, then you might try to extend it to more normal functions. And that would be an approach to quantum gravity. But out of there, you should be able to derive Einstein's equation as some kind of self-duality equation. Now, Einstein's equation is an equation G is 8 pi t. But notice this sign is geometry, this sign is quantum theory. So in a theory, in a paradigm where you have included both quantum theory and geometry in one unified category, you can write down a self-duality equation. And so this should hopefully appear as a self-duality equation. Okay, this is a dream that I've had for at least 15 years, or 20 years. General co-gravity. The other remark I want to make is that if you believe what I said, that h bar, that the curvilinear in space, that xi, xj is lambda, this corresponds to co-gravity, the curvilinear space. Okay, that mental space in this example is homogeneous, right? It's a homogeneous space. So if you were thinking about geometry more generally, you wouldn't be content just with homogeneous spaces. You would want to have a mental space that was not just a group or a homogeneous space, but an arbitrary Riemannian manifold or Riemannian manifold. So what does that translate into from the point of view of the Fourier transform? Well, that translates into the parameter here, lambda, being a function of p. So the non-homogeneous parameter might not be constant. It might depend on p. And that corresponds to physics. The dual picture we're more familiar with, that momentum, the covariant derivatives in a curved manifold don't commute. The curvature depends on x. So the dual of that is that the co-curvature, or the non-commutativity of the coordinate thing, should depend on p. And so this kind of idea has not been explored at all. So momentum dependent h-bar I should have written lambda here, but h-bar, whatever the combination parameter is, should depend on momentum. And that's so basically what the geodesics and mental space, what all those things correspond to. Remember that every phenomenon is a co-phenomenon. So doing the dual phenomena in a mental space corresponds to something in ordinary space, which we should know what to look for. So what's it correspond to? Okay, that is the end of my talk. I mean, I have some appendices, but answer questions.
So. Questions and okay, John.
What if you try to find a non-anti-Fermi geometry?
A non-what?
It's an anti-Fermi series of six
functions. Yeah. Well, that would just be another example of non-commutative geometry. So it would just be another example. It wouldn't be commutative. I think the supergeometry, supercommutative case, is, if you like, an example of non-commutative geometry already, and making that even more non-commutative would be deforming supergeometry. But they're all under the umbrella of non-commutative geometry, they're all within that umbrella. However, these techniques haven't been applied to supergeometry or even to their deformations. So there might be something interesting coming out
of it. I find some interesting differences between that and modern non-commutative
fabrication. Okay, that's interesting.
So your starting point seems to be in adopting this Hopf-Schultz and certain mathematical structure. How well motivated physically is that starting point? It seems to entail more than. Can you justify physically
that? Yeah. The least controversial is simply to say we expect that quantum gravity effects, we don't have to know quantum gravity theory to make predictions. We just have to have, because there will be an intermediate theory, an effective theory, which will be en route, which will be the next semi-classical, next to classical approximation. So non-commutative geometry is simply a generalization of ordinary geometry, which should be the right place to formulate that effective theory. So that's the motivation of non-commutative geometry in general. Now, within non-commutative geometry, the Hunting Group's approach to non-commutative geometry says that you should look at symmetry objects, because symmetry objects tell you what's really going on. If you just say that any algebra be a non-commutative space, you won't get anywhere unless you're Alan Kant. Even there, it takes you a long time. But if you have to think physically, then physically you should focus on symmetry, for symmetric objects like root manifolds, they have enough structure. And in fact, if you think about it, what a manifold really is, a manifold's ordinary geometry is really Rn glued together. So you first have to understand Rn, and you use the symmetry of Rn. Translation invariance of Rn is being used when you write down d by dxi. So therefore, to understand non-commutative geometry, you first have to understand groups, but now non-commutative coordinates, so that means quantum groups. So quantum groups are simply the most basic objects in non-commutative geometry, and non-commutative geometry itself is surely the receptacle for semi-classical, the next to classical approximation of geometry coming out of combinatorics or whatever it is that might be quantum gravity. So that's a good, that to my mind is a more or less incontrovertible physical motivation. But the as far as I began my talk with, all that double state duality, etc., that's my attempt. That's much more speculative, but that's my attempt to go deeper and ask, what is physics really? And there is a philosophical basis behind that, and I would say that, apart from me, I don't know anybody else who subscribes to it. Well, apparently some Russians also thought about this thing. So, but this is basically Born reciprocity. What I'm claiming is that Born reciprocity is broken when you look at a curved space, but it can be restored if you also have a quantum state, because the dual of curvature is quantum. So if you've got, in a theory of quantum gravity, Born reciprocity should be restored. So the philosophical idea is that this is pure philosophy, and nobody, I think, really takes it seriously except me. But
what is Born reciprocity?
Born reciprocity is this idea that every phenomenon in vision space, there should be a dual one in magic space, and vice versa. So, and that's really what I've been doing. But the thing is that when vision space is curved, when vision space is curved, magic is not space anymore, so Born couldn't be taken very far. But nowadays we can. It's just that the dual level curve position space is a non-committed dimension space. And so we can explore that idea, we can re-explore Born reciprocity using modern technology. And that translates over here in the category of hot boundaries to self-dual hot boundaries, and that's what these are. This is Born reciprocity, the position momentum, the dual hot boundary is exactly the same, but with the roles of X and G changed. So these models are forced. So basically, and I claim that this equation of forcing Born reciprocity in the category of hot boundaries, it requires conditions on M and G. These homogeneous spaces have to come in pairs, because one is this system, the other one is the dual system. And these equations that require are called match pair equations, and they are second order differential equations, or a pair of cross coupled first order differential equations. And they look somewhat like Einstein's equations. I mean, that's somewhat of a big quotation.
You claim to get T, to get time back,
yes,
facing various constraints. But these objects that you start with, which I guess end up being somehow mapping onto sort of operators for you, not very quantumly, there's something analogous to that anyway. I mean, to have a conceptual understanding of what those objects are in ordinary quantum theory, you have already time there.
So this is the problem with time. I would dispense with, showed you that you're forced to get a time adjoint with these relations, and you're forced to make a good equation. So the quantum mechanical time becomes the time that I've adjoined. I'm forced mathematically to by the anomaly.
So you tell a parallel physical story, so these operators correspond to sort of gates or some, and what do these operators correspond to physically?
That's a good question. So the xi's correspond to positions. Okay.
Is it dxi at a given time?
At a given time, because now we've got an algebra with x and t. So the coordinates, you shouldn't think of xi as a function of t. You should think that you're working in an algebra which is polynomial with an x and t, and that polynomial depends on x, depends on t. X is not a number, x is an observable. Mm-hmm. So its value will vary depending on the state. The wave function will. So what's really amazingly remarkable is that these wave functions psi and xt. I'm claiming Schrodinger's equation, but actually the x and t are actually viewed as operators, because it's something might not be viewed as algebra. And that's why I said that you shouldn't think of this lambda as not at h bar. You shouldn't confuse the non-commutativity of this algebra as to do with quantization. My x's and t's are non-commuting, or at least my x's are non-commuting. But that isn't really mixed up with Schrodinger's equation, which is what I'm saying here. I'm looking at the Schrodinger picture as regards ordinary quantum mechanics. But I'm working with non-commutative operators, which means a Heisenberg type picture, except that it's not quantum mechanics, it's a lambda, not h bar. It's co-gravity, it's not quantum theory, it's co-gravity that we're talking about here. We have to be using the technology of the Heisenberg picture, but philosophically speaking, it's not Heisenberg. It's not quantum mechanics for the XIs. Yeah? Is that partly answer the question?
You mentioned that the one of the features of co-gravity is that h bar depends on momentum.
It ought to. If you believe in Born reciprocity, you shouldn't have curvature with very x-dependent curvature, and have co-curvature always homogeneous.
Well, my question is that what are the other features of four gravity that one can actually check?
Well, the most important feature is that if the space is compact, if the momentum space is compact, like a sphere, like it was in this example, that will cause things to be discretized, and we saw that here in this model. So that, you know, that is an old observation, you know. So basically it gives you a momentum cutoff because momentum is compactified. It's this thing here. So curvature, the most important strong curvature, will have the effect of compactifying the space. And that will have the effect of having a Planckian bound. And that will give me a UV cutoff.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, actually I had a couple of just technical questions about what you were doing, but if there's time for that, but first in case there's not, let me ask some more general questions. One of them, anyway, which is about Lorentz invariants. So the way everything happens here, it looks very far from Lorentz.
Yeah, in this model is not relativistic. Because I start with the space, and I just forced to have this time, and I just didn't get it. Now, see, the thing about the model is I have no control over it. This is just what was forced out of the algebra. So that's what I got. However, there are other models, as I'm sure you know, like the Vytkovsky-Minkowski model, where you do have Lorentz invariants. So in this particular model, the only symmetry that I'm aware of is the symmetry of space itself. So the Planck arrangement, Euclidean motion ISO3, right, gets deformed to a quantum group. So that's there, because that's there in my original algebra. And that gets deformed to the semi-direct product, functions on SU2, semi-direct USU2. So this is angular momentum, and this is my curved momentum space. So my mental space generates.
Does U mean the universal
and L? Yeah. So SU2 acts on PIs by usual rotation. And the PIs themselves are the curved mental space generators. And the two together generate a quantum group, a non-trivial quantum group. And so that's the group of Euclidean motions is preserved. But how that extends to the Lorentzian case, whether there's a symmetry among the X and the T's, I don't know. And perhaps this model is intrinsically non-relativistic. But there are other models which are relativistic, which have a quantum Planck array group, as you know.
No, I actually don't know.
Oh,
I don't think I know.
Well, okay, so here's one. I have lots of appendices here. So that's the Vytkovsky product model. So this one, the three-dimensional version is back in my thesis, which even maybe you don't know. You have, so that's the three-dimensional version, but very similar, and it has this category.
3 is 3 plus 1, actually.
Yeah, this is 3 plus 0. So my thesis was 3 plus 0, but then in 94 with Rueg, I found the 3 plus 1 case, which as a whole happens isomorphic to the Kerski's Kaplan array, but everything else is different, so you shouldn't mix it up with the Kaplan array. But this is what I call the Vytkovsky-Planck model. But it has very similar relations, but just the tensor is spindled differently because there are different dimensions. But the structure is the same, and the Casimir is the same. There's a minus sign, look at that minus sign. So this model is Lorentzian. One thing I do want to stress on here is that this equation has no meaning whatsoever by itself. But this equation in conjunction with the physical thing that the P0s are relating to, which is this wave operator, these plane waves, that has physical meaning, because that tells you that on these plane waves, that's the Casimir. One without the other has no predictive power. I should mention that, because this requires some object of space-time, which you can't get it from the Planck array algebra alone. But that space-time is this one here. So that model is complementary to what I talked about, because here T is not central, but T is non-commuting, but the X-size commutes, so it's complementary to the model I talked about. And that has this Kaplan-Planck array, or Vytkovsky-Planck boundary with symmetry. And the relations are identical to the usual ones, so this is the only deformed one, and this is the only deformed coproduct. So everything else is as it would be classically.
This is the
correct way to think about kappa. As a hot boundary, it's isomorphic to the Kerski kappa Planck array, but in fact, it generates a completely different. So his Lorentz boost generators don't close among themselves. So these are completely different generators. So I would say it's different physics. And what's happening here is that the mass shell that deforms the dispersion relation means that the light cone in momentum space is being deformed. And that Planckian bound for a massless particle is also visible there. So this Lorentzian model with Planckian bound. And that's what's happening here. This light cone, 45 degrees, being bent upwards into a cylinder. And there's actually an asymptote at lambda, and so P is one over lambda. This diagram is the units of one over lambda. So the mass shell is being deformed upwards into a cylinder. And that's why particle over here, as you boost it, has higher and higher velocity. And see, this is the model that predicts variable speed of light. That's what's written here. And has a Planckian bound and is relativistic in the sense of a quantum group Planckian group. So that's a lot of people here have worked on this, so they know that. And that's just there.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
So I agree with you that we need plane waves, especially like physical interpretation of momentum. One thing is, for a plane wave, you need space time, and you need a contraction between space time and momentum.
Yes.
Isn't it an easier way to do it? Just say that space time becomes energy dependent rather than momentum isn't dependent.
Well, actually, I don't know if that's an easy way, but actually, that's what I'm saying. Right? With language, if you want to another way, not this model, but some other model, you would have the parameter here to depend on energy.
But forget about.
Okay. You mean this particular model can be said more easily as.
The thing I'm wondering is that you don't need no primitivity at all.
You see, you can write this equation here, right? And think, oh, look, that's wonderful. I've got all the predictions from this equation, but that's complete nonsense because these are just numbers. Who knows? I could choose new variables, p0 till and pi till, in which these relations become the usual ones.
I agree with you. But
so the only
thing I'm saying to represent those plane waves.
You need that x and t, and you need these plane waves with t and x here. So that in conjunction with that, now you can't do away with this because then you wouldn't have any interpretation of this equation.
No, I agree with you. So I don't think you need to have no primitivity either in t or x, where the next dot p, which is invariant with those special relations.
Well, you know,
it's just not. Basically, you need to mix momentum space and real space. That's the only problem.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, the other thing I would like to do is to make sure that you know I'm willing to look at other models, but you would like to know that you have some geometry in position space. And you're going to say, well, I'll mix them. Like that. In fact, Snyder didn't introduce only geometry. He introduced the idea of mixing momentum and angular momentum, position space and angular momentum. In the 40s. And so that's an example of that type. But the thing is, you can only go so far without understanding the geometry. If you understand the geometry, you've got to know what happens to your additive group structures. Because in the limit, there's going to be ordinary Rn. And so the only way, you can write down something, but you'll never understand it fully unless you understand what happens to all of the geometry. And this, so knowing geometry is simply the way of doing that. At the end of the day, you will have this equation here. You'll still have to know how to detect these things, and that's a big unsolved problem.
Well, this is the thing. I think what you need is a field theory,
yeah.
Which actually has those plane waves.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately actually from the first principles.
You can even write down the final rules, but you don't know how to interpret them. You don't know how to build a detector for those kinds of particles. There's a lot of physics that you don't know. And the only way you're going to get to that physics is not to hide the mathematical structure, but to bring out the mathematical structure, in my opinion. So.
I think this is the start of a longer conversation with cars.
About 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I put out a paper where I completely generalized the form of reciprocity.
Okay.
And I had a general metric of momentum space and one in x space.
Oh, okay, I'd like to see that.
I wrote down Einstein's equation for both spaces. Had a quantity type group of momentum space,
right.
A kind of racing branch. And I regularized with the blah blah, and I met with a lot of sociological opposition by physicists to generalizing the form of reciprocity.
Right. Well, so I'm like you, I've also met the proposition. I'm very happy to hear that, and I'd like to talk about it. So, I mean, these ideas of mine go back to the 80s, but I've always been my dream to do what you just said, so if you've done it, I'd like to see it. But, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of work to be done by Sarah.
I just put it out, but I think the
answer is... another Sarah conversation.
This is a question concerning your theta. You're trying to really come from the special element of theta, right? Are there any special or classes of algebras where you have more than one choice of theta and you have this problem of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there are certainly a lot of hot problems. What we can prove is that all standard quantum groups, for example, will not have, for all SLM, for example, all quantum SLM, there will be a one-dimensional extension. But for all other quantum groups, there will be more than one direction. However, only one of them, many of them will be auxiliary here. So there will usually be one theta which has this property here. And there will still be even more directions, which don't have this property. So there's one important canonical element, and then there will usually be even more directions, which is sort of generated from theta, so there will be auxiliary directions as well being added. So the answer is that theta is in some sense unique up to some inner automorphism, but theta is not necessarily the whole story. There could even be other directions that you're forced to add, but they all somehow have the auxiliary to one primary direction characterized by this property. So it's not just the fact you have to extend the counter, you have to extend it with this relation.
So, for example, then, when you look at the later generalization where you have capital and class C space, there's no notion of a Lorentz transformation that connects.
It depends on how non-commutative it is, because that model is so non-commutative, it's so commutative, that one doesn't actually generate time. That model already has a calculus, and the calculus is just theta is dt. It's already got t, and theta is dt has the only calculus that I've been described by, but that calculus is something like dtx xi is lambda dxi. So it already has the required property. So in this model, you don't have to add joint time, and that's lucky because it's not adjoint, because it's already too commutative. This theorem I told you requires the algebra to be sufficiently non-commutative. So it's not commutative itself that forces the dimension. But this algebra here, the spatial part, it's so commutative that it doesn't actually force anything. But luckily, we don't need to because there's already a element. This element feature will exist, but it doesn't have to be forced.
I was thinking actually of 3+1 case.
This is 3+1.
Talking about 3.
Yeah, 3 or that's in 1, I is 1, 2, but here it's 3+1, I is 1, 2, 3, and you've got T as well. These are the same family, it's a family of models of this type. So in the punch part models, you don't have to, there's not non-commutative enough to force time, but you still have this property, so the property is quite general. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
My question is, what are natural morphisms in this approach? So when I do algebra or group theory, I just consider isomorphisms as natural morphisms. Whereas in case of quantum SU2, there's only kind of one dimensional.
No, it's the same thing. You define a morphism in the category of you're talking about things which are being covariant under some quantum group in the same way as things are being covariant under some group. And a morphism is something which commutes with the actual group. So a morphism in this context are things that are covariant under a quantum group. So it means that the morphism commutes, and that commutes an intertwining. I'm not sure okay. Your question is about working with covariant objects under the quantum group, or is it about quantum groups themselves?
My question is, what is kind of gauge
transformation? Gauge transformation. Okay. Obviously that's a whole other talk. But in the 90s, 92, so around that time, Brzezinski and I have a formulation of quantum group gauge theory. So gauge theory with a fiber being a quantum group, and there's a well-defined notion, etc., and it all works. However, gauge transformation is not the right way to think about it. What gauge transformation is really a way in physics of making sure that things are coordinate invariant. However, if you're working with the algebra and you haven't chosen any coordinates, everything's already coordinate invariant. So you can write down gauge theory without any special choice of coordinates, depending only on the algebra. And that is already manifestly coordinate invariant, and that somehow replaces gauge transformation. In a sense, you can choose any coordinates you like. But if you don't really have gauge transformation as such, put it another way, you don't have patches, you don't have open sets, you don't have points. So you don't have open sets, you don't have patches. All of the conventional framework of gauge theory with open sets, intersections and things, all the transition functions, all have to get thrown out. However, there is a completely coordinate invariant replacement for all those concepts. Okay. I can tell you that. So there's a theory of quantum principal bundles with quantum group fiber. And there is a theory of being able to choose any choice of coordinates you like, and that replaces notion of gauge invariance. That's not going to make us happy, but have fun, mine hasn't caught on yet.
I think at this point what I'm going to do is close this. There are many discussions that many just want to have with Sean, which is why it's good he's here for several more months. So. Yes, I have already announced it. You were there. So, Brandon, I have to run away. Very, very nice.
Okay, good. I enjoyed it. So, age before beauty or beauty before age? Sorry.
Okay. It's good for me to be getting out of
it. You probably should have priority, right? So, you have. Okay, yeah. Using the I mean, basically, I can either do more about cattle pump for age, if you're interested in.